Under individualism and patriarchy, you can either be connected or you can be powerful, but you can't be both at the same time. Leading men and women and non-binary folk into intimacy is synonymous with leading them beyond patriarchy and this culture of individualism. It's really a new frontier for all of us.
So what if being fiercely self-reliant and individualistic was actually a kind of a terrible thing? I know. It sounds silly, right? I mean, isn't that the very thing we're told to strive for from the youngest age? And especially in our culture now as adults? Well, the problem is living in a me first or a me over you world is not only destroying our personal relationships, it's destroying us, our states of mind, and even our physical well-being. And intimacy, deep connectedness, even reliance on and elevating others just might be the solution to much of what ails us. Now, that idea may sound a little bit strange at first. It's hard to argue that the rise of a wildly individualistic society has also gone hand in hand with the destruction of social bonds and friendship, mental health, and nearly every marker of health in communities as well. It turns out that as humans, we're all designed to be in relationship with each other, to experience the positive effects of connectedness. And when that breaks down, well, so do we. And today's guest, Terry Real, who likes to joke that he began his career as a family therapist at the age of 4, drives home this point in a fascinating conversation on intimacy, interconnectedness, trauma, relationships, and the power of us, especially at this moment in time. Terry is an internationally recognized family therapist, speaker, and author. He founded the Relational Life Institute, offering workshops for couples, individuals, and parents, and a professional training program for clinicians to learn his relational life therapy methodology. In addition to being a therapist and a teacher for over 25 years now, Terry is also the best-selling author of I Don't Want to Talk About It, How Can I Get Through to You, and The New Rules of Marriage. And his new book, Us, Getting Past You and Me to Build a More Loving Relationship. It's a guide not just for couples, but also for really all human beings, filled with tools and advice and help for anyone to tap into their most collaborative and relational self. In today's conversation, we dive into all these different topics with Terry, and he shares his own story of growing up in a pretty dysfunctional home, the way he describes it, to reveal how the techniques that we have all learned to survive dysfunction as children can take a toll on our present relationships and lives when we bring them into our grown-up existence. And we explore how re-engaging with people around us that we hold most dear, and maybe those that we don't hold most dear but would like to, how that just may save not only those relationships but our lives as well and society more broadly. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You know, it's interesting. I heard you say not too long ago that you described sort of like a family lineage of being the son of a depressed, angry dad who lived in an unhappy marriage, who was himself the son of a depressed, angry dad who lived in an unhappy marriage. When I hear things like that, one of my curiosities, I mean, I have a whole bunch of curiosity, but one of them is, Do you have a sense for how old you were, how young you were when you really first started becoming aware of that?
You know, Jonathan, I tease and say I began my career as a family therapist at about the age of four. A lot of people have noted this. When you're a child in a dysfunctional home, if you're a woman connected to a grandiose man, if you're a member of a marginalized minority group dealing with someone from the majority, you develop great sensitivity. It's what Alice Miller called the drama of the gifted child. The gift is the gift of being able to read people, and you read them because you know at 3, 4 that it's in your interest to keep these people regulated because when they aren't regulated, you pay for it. So one of my gifts, and I think this is gendered, I think it's because I was a boy, I never took it in. I never was swamped with great shame, and there was plenty of it, but not. I didn't feel like I was nuts. I knew at a very early age that they were nuts. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't a caretaker, that I didn't love them and want to make them better, and that my life didn't depend on it. So my adaptation, we're going to talk a lot about what I call the adaptive child part of us. My adaptation from as far back as I can remember is the gift of knowing how to read a room and the burden of feeling like it was my responsibility to keep that room safe, like all traumatized kids, so that I could be safe.
Yeah, and I mean, it occurs to me also that what might go along with that is a sense of, you know, hypervigilance. It's like perpetual scanning mode, which can have its benefits. You know, you really become aware of social dynamics and context and subtext. But at the same time, that level of sustained hypervigilance there's got to be a side of it that takes something from you as well.
Yeah, well, we know this from trauma. This is the hallmark of trauma. When you're in a dangerous environment, and that very much includes emotionally, you know, they've done research, and people who have been subject to both physical and emotional abuse will tell you they prefer the physical abuse, no problem. It's the emotional abuse that really gets to you. And when you grow up in a dangerous environment, your central nervous system is being formed. You're in a state of fight or flight, of hypervigilance, while your nerves are being grown. And the consequence of that, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out, is that your hair trigger from that point forward. But you know what? When it comes to trauma, you can have a ton of it and grow up in an overtly violent home the way I did. You can have subtle trauma, we call it little t trauma, relational trauma. It's more like water on a stone. You can have misalignment that hurts, that's repeated 100 million times a year. And the wound and the adaptation to the wound are still very much a part of who you are and what you bring into your current relationships. That's what my new book is all about. How to understand your particular wound, and more important, the way you adapted to that wound. How that adaptive part of us, I call it the adaptive child part of us, spills into your relationships and makes a mess of things. And how to move into a wiser part of us, a less triggered part of us. It's literally a different part of our brain. It's the prefrontal cortex. And that's the part of us that's here and now and not triggered, the part that can stop and think and reason. You know, one of the things I say is, there's no such thing as overreacting. It's just that what you're reacting to may not be what's in front of you.
Mm.
It may be what's behind you. Your past, you know, there's no such thing as trauma memory. That's a misnomer. You don't remember trauma, you relive it. You're not thinking, I'm walking down Main Street remembering combat. You hear a noise, you've got a gun in your hand, you're back in combat. And so what happens when we're flooded and we get triggered whenever anything in the present comes close enough to what happened to you as a kid, that you get confused. And the past overtakes the present in your body, viscerally. And you are back there. You know, my dad was a harsh, violent guy. He was also a very loving guy. He was both. Confusing. My wife speaks to me harshly or she's critical to me. Boom. I am that four-year-old. She is that six-foot-three towering man. And my defenses are up. My knee-jerk automatic response, my adaptive child, is fight. And so is hers. So we're off to the races. The essence, how you know you're in your triggered adaptive child, is how automatic it is. Mm. It's not thoughtful. It's knee-jerk. And for those of you listening to the podcast, I have three: fight, flight, and fix. Are you? And you can flee, by the way, sitting 6 inches away from somebody. That's called stonewalling. But are you a fighter, like me, screw you? Are you a fleer? I'm going to shut down. I'm not listening. I'm out of here. Or are you a fixer? Oh my God, something's bad. Let me fix it so that I can feel better. Fight, flight, or fix. Take a moment, if you're listening, and be honest with yourself. What is the adaptive child part of you? When in the heated moment, where do you go? And Jonathan, where do you go?
I am, it's interesting as you're laying that out, you know, and I had an immediate different reaction too. I learned years ago this sort of like the sympathetic and parasympathetic response, fight or flight. And then it seems like that model had evolved to fight, flight, or freeze. You know, like right. There was this understanding that sometimes we just become utterly paralyzed and we do neither. So you swap in this sort of like thing, which is fix, as part of sort of the polyvagal spectrum, which is fascinating to me.
It's in the literature now. It's actually fight, flight, freeze. And I collapse freeze and I call freeze frozen flight. Mm. But I'll include it. Fight, flight, freeze, or fawn.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Tell me about that part.
Well, that's when the animal, you know, rolls over on his belly or starts right. licking the paws of the more dominant animal. It's like, I'll be subservient to you. Let me regulate you so you don't attack me. And that fawn in the animal kingdom, I speak of in humans as fixing. It's not an adult responsible, let me see what I can do here. Right. It's a compulsive, anxiety-driven, I won't feel good unless you feel good. Let me make you feel good at all costs.
Right. It's sort of let me subsume my identity into the, like whatever I think is going to bring peace in the moment, even if it completely is not in service of my own humanity.
Yes. So do you can pass if you want, but I'm wondering.
Yeah, no, I'm curious. And I was thinking, I said, you know, I think in an earlier part of my life, I would say it would have been flight. You know, any sort of experience that was relationship-based where I saw, you know, the opportunity for conflict, I would probably just try and check out. I was very avoidant. And what's interesting is when I think about the word fight, it doesn't resonate with me because I'm also at this point in my life, having been knocked around enough and having a pretty devout mindfulness and meditation practice for about a dozen years, I feel like the response for me is more zoom out, pause, and then engage probably on the what you would designate as fight side of it, but not in an adversarial way, more in an engaged responsive way. At least that's my sense of it. It'd be interesting to ask my wife, actually, what her sense is from the other side.
And what is your new hard-won fight response look or sound like? I'm trying to figure out if you're fighting out of your adaptive child or if you're standing up for yourself out of your wise adult.
Yeah, I would probably say it depends on the moment and the circumstance. You know, my sense is that it's more standing up for myself rather than defaulting to some sort of adaptive child slash, you know, like coping mechanism. And I wonder if part of that is because I felt safe as a child. I felt loved as a child. I felt like I could be who I needed to be and had parents who modeled that, even though they ended up not with each other. Mm. And so I wonder if part of that is that actually I was given a lot of what I yearn for, to feel safe and comfortable and able to express myself as a child. And that patterning has followed me for a large part of my life.
Well, Jonathan, you may be healthy.
No.
It's been, you know, over 30 years of being a therapist, I've collected a lot of cartoons. And yeah. One of them was this huge sort of convention hall. And the banner read, "Adult Children of Healthy Parents." And there were like four people in the. But that might be a healthy response, particularly as you describe it, that you stop and pause.
Yeah.
And then make a decision. That stopping and pausing is you pulling out of the triggered subcortical parts of your brain, fight, flight, or fix, and accessing the prefrontal cortex, the wise adult, the part of you that can really be there and make a conscious choice to do something more functional. I'm going to say your adaptive child is a fleer, and that in your wise old age, you have developed what my book is all about, what I call relational mindfulness, the capacity in the heated moment to take a breath or 20, take a break. I'm a big fan of breaks. Take a walk around the block. Get recentered until you're out of that automatic triggered response. It's what I call remembering love. Remember the person you're speaking to is someone you care about. Remember why you're opening your mouth is to make things better. And when you're recentered in that wiser part of you, then you go back into the fray and deal with what was ever upsetting. But I do have a note on how to stand up for yourself. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, please.
See, the essence of this new book is about learning to live relationally. It's us. It's the prefrontal cortex has the capacity to remember that we're a whole, that we're a team. When you get triggered and you move into that trauma response, you forget that. You don't have the more primitive parts of the brain that light up don't have the capacity to remember the whole. And so it's you and me, adversaries in a power struggle. One wins, one loses. When you're there, get out. You're not in your right mind. Take a break and get centered, and then use relational skills. One of the bitter pills is that this triggered, automatic, reactive part of us, it does not want to be intimate. It wants survival. It's about me, me, me. You know, for decades, I ran around the country giving skills workshops. And my favorite slide was this one. Other workshops teach you skills. We deal with the part of you that won't use them. So anyway, the book Us is very much a critique of what I call the toxic culture of individualism
right.
in the West. And what thinking like an individual does in your relationship to yourself, self-esteem, to others, the people you live with, and to other races, other cultures, to the planet. And recovering the us, remembering that we're a team together, is a completely different energy and language than you versus me. Now, a lot of people, when they stand up for themselves, they do so as an individual. And a lot of therapists and 12-step sponsors and feminist groups will cheer you on. I wouldn't take that bullshit if I... No. It's not, I was weak, now I'm strong, go screw yourself. It's, I was weak, now I'm strong. Let's empower each other to make this work for both of us. That's thinking relationally. It's a whole different ballgame. So what I teach people, and I go into this in detail in the book, is what I call soft power or loving power. Under individualism and patriarchy, which I've been writing about for 30 years, you can either be connected or you can be powerful, but you can't be both at the same time. When you step into power, because power is dominance, power is power over, not with. When you step into power, you break the connection. And one of the things I say is that leading men and women and non-binary folk into intimacy is synonymous with leading them beyond patriarchy and this culture of individualism. It's really a new frontier for all of us. So what does soft power sound like? Instead of, Jonathan, don't talk to me like that, which is fair enough, it becomes, Jonathan, I want to hear what you have to say. Could you tone it down so I can really listen to it? Instead of saying, don't treat me like that, you say, honey, when you just called me a big fat pig, it pushed me to the other side of the room. I would like to be close to you. Could you say you're sorry and make some repairs so I can feel close to you again? Who the hell talks like that? Who the hell stands up for themselves and cherishes their partner in the same breath? It's new territory, and that's what I've been writing about. Can I tell you a story?
Yeah, please.
I love to tell it. This is an absolutely true story. So a heterosexual couple comes to me, young, and it's a classic deal. She wants sex none of the time. He wants sex all the time. So like any good therapist, I get them off of the actual thing into what it means. What does it mean to you to have sex? And this guy, unfortunately, like a lot of men, filtered almost all of his emotional needs through the physicality. It meant he was desirable, she liked him, they were on the same page, they were close, things were good between, it meant everything. So they come back 2 weeks later. It's absolutely true. All smiles, I said, the sex thing, we got it knocked. Okay, what's the story? About 3 days after our session, the woman tells me, my husband wanted sex. And instead of my usual, which is to go to the other side of the room, I walked over to him, I gave him a big fat kiss, put my arms around him, looked him in the eyes, and said something like this. Honey, the first thing I want you to know is I think you're really hot. You got a great bod. You're a really handsome man. You turn me on. And more than that, you're a good man. I feel loved by you. I feel close to you. I want to be in your arms. I think, oh, by the way, I don't want to have sex tonight. Anyway, I think you're wonderful, and I feel real. And to his amazement, the guy looked at her and went, okay. And they were done. And the reason why they were done is she said yes to him in so many wonderful ways that the no of not having sex went down like not a problem. We don't know how to say no to a particular issue and yes to our partners in the same breath. That's new territory for us, and most of us have to learn how to do that.
Yeah, and what a beautiful story. You know, I would imagine that so much of that is that we are – without the objectivity of somebody, like going to somebody who can sort of like sit between us and say, like, have you thought that maybe there's this bigger dynamic happening, that the ability for two people or three people, people in relationship, to sort of pull out and gather that level of understanding and say, well, this is not actually about the, in this case, the sex. It's about all of the associations about identity that I'm folding into this act. And feeling like rejecting the act is rejecting all of these things that I hold dearly onto as like a source of identity for me. How does somebody get to the place where they are able to sort of zoom the lens out and identify and the nuance, what's really happening below the surface? Because you can't have the reaction that you just talked about until you can actually see what's really going on.
Well, you can learn to say yes while you stand up for yourself and then apply it to a particular situation. But the only part of you that is capable of doing that is the non-triggered adult part of you. I have a saying, there's no such thing as overreaction. It's just that what we're reacting to may not be what's in front of us. It may be what's behind us. So the principal art is staying seated in this adult that can learn these skills. And you can learn these skills, including the, in some ways, most important skill, the fundamental skill of righting yourself when you're reactive and triggered, taking a break, taking a walk around the block, having a little chat with that little boy or little girl that is what is being triggered. It's not you, it's that young version of you. And getting recentered into the place of you that can remember love and use these skills. And the skills can be used cross-issue. You don't have to be a psychoanalyst and unearth the deeper meaning of every issue. You can learn how to be more related. Can I give you another concrete skill?
Yeah, sure.
So first of all, you change the map. You move from thinking like two adversarial individuals, and you remember the us, the team. That changes everything. The relational answer to the question, for example, who's right and who's wrong, is who cares? It doesn't matter. What matters is how are we going to work this issue in a way that works for both of us. So changing the map and learning to think relationally changes everything. It's like the difference between, I need more sex in here, and honey, we both deserve a good sex life. What do we need to do together to jumpstart this thing? It's a completely different energy and a completely different language and a completely different toolbox. So here's a tool. You and me consciousness versus us consciousness. When we are faced with a unhappy, angry, complaining partner, in other words, when the moment calls for repair, I'll talk more about repair, we lose our shit. And we usually reference two reference points. I talk to this day in and day out in my office. Our first reference point is accuracy. Well, that's right. That's half right. Yeah, that's sort of right, but you have to understand that. Here's the first bitter pill. There's no place for objective reality in personal relationships. Objective reality is great for getting, you know, a vaccine made. But it's irrelevant in personal relationships. We don't care who's objectively right or wrong. The second reference that we all go to is us, me. I can't believe I have to put up with this shit. Here we go again, blah, 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 blah. How unfair is this? How long is this going to go on for? And what I teach people, and it's literally a teaching, I want you to give up those two reference points, objective reality and me, me, me. And as an act of generosity, I want you to lose your ego, walk over the bridge to your partner's, this is what I want you to replace it with, compassionate curiosity about your partner's subjective experience. It's not about setting the record straight. It's not about you, you, you. And it sounds as simple as this. Honey, I'm sorry you feel bad. I love you. I don't want you to feel bad. Tell me what's going on. Tell me more about it. That's all you need. And if you really want an A+, you get to say, I can understand how you might feel like that. That's empathy. And if you want an A++, you get this punchline. This is a line I would like all your listeners to jot down. Honey, is there anything I could say or do right now that would help you feel better? That's called repair. What do you need? Is there something I can say or do right now that would help you feel better? But you have to put yourself aside, and you have to put the record aside, and you have to be willing to be generous to your partner in their distress. Reach in to their upset and see if you can. Everybody gets this wrong. Now, all relationships are a dance of harmony, disharmony, and repair. And our culture doesn't teach the skills of repair. It doesn't even acknowledge that disharmony exists. But when you're faced with an unhappy partner, start off with the wisdom that is in your interest to help them be happy with you. It's in your interest. This is not a dialogue. Everybody gets this wrong. It's a one-way street. I tell people, think of yourself as being at the customer service window. Somebody comes to you and says, my microwave doesn't work. They don't want to hear you say, well, my toaster doesn't work. They want you to fix their damn microwave. When you are faced with an unhappy partner, help them get happier. It's in your interest to do that. You love them and you're there. You know, I have these big burly guys, Jonathan, and they say to me, why should I work so hard to please my wife? And I go, knock, knock, dummy, you live with her, okay? That's why you should. It's in your interest. But that's remembering the us, the whole.
Yeah, I mean, it's a powerful sort of way to re-examine it, the notion of harmony, disharmony, and then to really focus on, like, what is the process of repair here?
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight-up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Good Life Project is brought to you by Aqua Chew, my trusty partner for delicious pure water. So I will admit, I was skeptical that a countertop device could transform my tap water, but one sip of Aqua Chew's reverse osmosis filtered water pretty much washed all my doubts away. It is so fresh and clean. My family guzzles it nonstop. Aqua Chew removes over 80 contaminants like PFAS, lead, and chlorine. The filters last 2 years, saving cash and keeping plastic from the environment. It's so easy to install in just minutes, so it's really perfect for renters as well. And I also appreciate Aqua Chew's mission to provide clean water access for communities in need. They walk the walk on health and social impact. So transform your tap into a fountain of health and yumminess with Aqua Chew. Aqua Chew comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee and even makes a great gift. Today, our listeners receive 20% off any Aqua Chew purifier. Just go to aquachew.com, that's AQUATRU.com, and enter the code GOODLIFE at checkout. That's 20% off any Aqua Chew water purifier when you go to aquachew.com or click the link in the show notes and use the promo code GOODLIFE. What occurs to me also is, like, I wonder if there is a bit of a slippery slope. You described earlier these sort of different states, fight, flight, freeze, or fix, and then fawn was this fourth one. Is there a slippery slope between repair and fawn?
There can be. It depends on which part of you is at the wheel. You know, when I talk about remembering the us, look, I consider myself a feminist family therapist. I have been for 40 years. And I'm not unaware of how many women traditionally have subsumed their voice, their wants and needs, for the sake of peace in the relationship. I ain't talking about that. I like to say in relationships, I want the mighty to melt. I want the weak to stand up. And both of those moves are a move into increased vulnerability. For the big puffed up one, the grandiose one, it's vulnerable to come down and open your heart and say, I'm scared. For the more quote unquote codependent one, the one down, placating one. It's a move into vulnerability to assert yourself and stand up. So I'm not talking about doing away with the individual. I'm just talking about keeping the individual in context. And a lot of people shift from being over-accommodating to, now I found my voice, go screw yourself. That's not a step up. You know, I'll get killed for this, but one of the things I say is that after 50 years of feminism, a lot of women have earned the right to be as obnoxious as men have always been. I don't want you to shift from one side or to the other side of the dichotomy. I want to blow up the dichotomy. I want related, loving power. A lot of 12-step therapy, you know, as a couples therapist, individual therapy is the bane of my existence. I wouldn't put up with that if I was you. And people get, I call it individual empowerment. I don't want you to be individually empowered. I want you to be relationally empowered. I'm going to bring my full strength into this relationship. I'm going to insist on what I want. Now, what do you need, honey? How can I help you deliver for me? Who says that? The golden rule of thinking relationally is, what could I give you to help you come through for me? That's thinking relationally. We're a team. Let me empower you to deliver for me what I'm asking for. This is not an adversarial contest. We need to work together.
So if we define power as something that derives from some sort of relationship or collective effort, what happens when a person is not in a relationship or in some sort of community? If their sense of power is derived largely from interacting with others, and they're in a moment or a stage in their life where they're sort of like in relative solitude, how does that affect the individual's sense of power?
Well, first of all, I make a distinction. It's Rhianne Eisler, actually, the chalice and the blade, between what we call power over versus power with.
Okay.
Dominance versus agency. And the whole book is about trading in the delusion of power over and control for the wisdom of cooperation and collaboration with yourself. You know, before I answer your question, let me back up a bit. This book is a critique of the toxic culture of individualism.
Right.
And what that means is, the word individual means I'm apart from nature. I'm an individual. And individualism, which has one of the chapters is the history of it was created by a bunch of, guess what, wealthy, privileged white men in the Enlightenment. It hasn't been around forever. But individualism fuses with patriarchy, which I've been writing about for 30 years. Patriarchy teaches us not only are we apart from nature, but we're above nature and we control it. We dominate it. Whether the nature you're trying to dominate is your partner or your kids or the result of your efforts, like landing that job, or your brain, I need to be less negative, or your body, I need to lose 10 pounds. This power over control model is insane, and it wreaks havoc in our relationship to ourselves, in our relationships to the people we love, in our society. We're living now in an extremely divisive one-up, one-down culture, and to the planet and to spirit. And the essence, and I'm proud to say, I start with neurobiology in the book, what happens in our brains. And I move to personal relationships, and it's full of relationship skills. The last third of the book zooms out, and I talk about this power over model in terms of racism, sexism, homophobia, our relationship to nature itself, to the planet, and to spirit. If we don't trade in the dominance power over model for I call it ecological humility, the understanding that we're in our systems, not above it. If we don't move from dominance to collaboration, we're in deep shit as a species. So anyway, I define power as agency, not dominance.
Got it.
But let me answer your question. Somebody out of relationships. Jonathan, I've never met anybody out of relationships. I don't know if you have. These are the same relationship skills. If it's work or your family at home or your dog or the kids on the playground, relationship skills are relationship skills. It's about how you relate to your garden. It's about shifting from you versus me, power and control, to you and me together. I am in this with you, not at you. And that shift can be the way that you drive your car.
Yeah. And I love that context. And also, if you think about it, just the way that you step into your life, the way that you step into every part of your life, you know, if you step in with the frame of how can we all collaborate in a way that feels amazing to all of us. And like, and you constantly are asking that question, how do we all win? How do we all do this together in a way where we all rise, rather than how do I set this up so that I am the one who ends with the most? I mean, the former just feels like such a more joyful way to step into your life, to step into conversations, to step into walking in the woods. And like you said, we're relating to everything and everyone all day long. And if you go in there, you know, with this just much more expansive view, it just feels like a more energizing, a more upbeat, a more nourishing way to live your life, because you're removing a lot of the adversarial context of moving through each day by doing that.
I think that's right. I don't move through my day as an adversary. I move through my day as a participant. One of the things I say is our relationships are our biosphere. It's the atmosphere we breathe. And once we replace dominance for what I call ecological humility, understanding we're not above it, we're in it, then everything, it changes. You know, as a couples therapist, let me tell you, if one of you wins and the other one loses, you both lose. Now, that's not pie in the sky idealism. You both lose because I've seen it. The loser will make the winner pay for it. Trust me. You're not outside of the dance. You're in it. You're intimately connected. And so it's in your interest to take care of the biosphere because you're dependent upon it. You breathe. You can pollute your biosphere over here with a temper tantrum, but you'll breathe in that pollution in your partner's withdrawal or sexlessness or coldness. You are connected. You cannot escape. And once you wake up to the interconnectedness that is the net we all live in, all of the rules change. It's not about me, 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 me. Whether you're walking in the woods, whether you're fighting, hopefully constructively, with your partner, it's about the whole and how are we as a whole going to make this work.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you dive into the neurophysiology of individualism, which I thought was fascinating. And you describe this phenomenon you call social baseline theory, this notion that our brains are actually not designed to self-regulate in isolation. Talk to me more about this. I found this fascinating.
Well, what we've learned about the brain from a neurological perspective, this idea of the freestanding, rugged individual is just bullshit. That's not how we're designed. We co-regulate each other's nervous systems all day long, and we depend upon it. You know, one of the things I say in the book is, if you want to see what happens to a nervous system that's completely cut off from social interaction, look at what solitary confinement does to somebody. It drives them crazy. Dan Siegel, pioneer of neurobiology, has said social interaction is not a luxury. It is an essential nutrient to the brain. We need it. So social baseline theory is one of the newer theories that I like a lot. It goes like this. We know that all animals are calorie counters. All animals conserve energy. As I introduced this concept, I talked about being in the Serengeti, and I saw a lioness hunting a warthog, and they were crouched in the grass, and then boom, they both took off. And then just as suddenly, boom, they both stopped, dead stop, in utter unison. And I turned to my friend who was an old safari hand. I said, what the hell? He said, conservation of calories. I said, what? He said, that moment was the moment both Lion and Warthog knew the Warthog would never be caught. And they just stopped. Why expend your energy? Now, the way this works in the brain, we've known this forever, is the prefrontal cortex, the most mature part of our brain, which develops up to 26 years old, develops last, is an energy hog. You know, it's like the CPU that takes a lot of electricity. And this more mature part of the brain offloads more rudimentary tasks to less calorie-consuming parts of the brain, simpler parts of the brain, like breathing, for example, or your heart rate. We know that. What we didn't know until very recently is you can offload your brain to other people's brains. Simple example. I tend the fire, and I'm looking out for saber-toothed tigers. My prefrontal cortex is working overtime. Versus, I tend the fire, and my cave mate, Ralph, stands behind me, and he looks for saber-toothed tigers. Much less expenditure in my brain. My brain is working less because the two of us are sharing one brain. And we share brains like this all day long. They call it social baseline theory. The brain operates at rest when it's in a social matrix. The brain operates actually more actively when you're alone. It calms down when you're with others because we share brain functions. This is a revolutionary way of looking at how we operate. It's so extraordinary that the new neurobiologists are saying the individual may not be the proper study of science. It should be the collective. That is, how do we stay healthy? With others. How do our brains work? With others. How do we regulate? We co-regulate. So this whole idea of an individual who does everything for himself is just not how we human beings operate. It's a myth.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense, frankly. You know, that's the reason that we still exist as human beings, is because enough people figured out that I can't do this thing alone, that they decided to support themselves in community. Although certainly the last few years, I think, is challenging a lot of that. There is so much rhetoric, so many resources being put behind this notion of individualism, and that being, you know, like the ultimate aspiration for us as human beings. And
it's just a recipe for violence and for loneliness. And we've never been a more lonely society than we are right now. I'm me. We're pack animals. We're designed to be connected and relational. It's how our bodies work best. You know, intimacy is as much a factor in physical health as and not smoking and eating right and exercise. One of my favorite studies was there was a study. There are hundreds of studies that intimacy it does well for our body. But one of my favorites is there was a study. It talked about simplicity. A Dartmouth study, people recovering from surgery in the hospital had shorter stays in the hospital correlated to how many visitors they had. The more visitors you had, the quicker you were back home. We are born to be connected. It's the only thing that makes us happy. And one of the things I say in the book is, look at addiction. What we self-medicate when we self-medicate is the pain of disconnection. I gave a talk for a group once. I said the cure for sex addiction is intimacy. I think the cure for most everything is intimacy. It's what we're designed to be.
Yeah. Good Life Project is sponsored by NetSuite. So I remember when our businesses were just starting to really scale. It was amazing and also added complexity and stress. And the things that I used to do in hours were taking days, too many spreadsheets, too many systems, no single source of truth. If that sounds familiar, you should know these numbers. 37,000 25, and 1. 37,000 businesses have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And 1, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your key performance indicators in one efficient system with one source of truth, manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. And right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/goodlife. That's netsuite.com/goodlife to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/goodlife.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I remember looking at some of the research that John Cacioppo, who like was one of the leading researchers in loneliness for years, who's no longer with us, sadly, but reading about the research on loneliness, which is very different than being alone. You can be surrounded by people and still feel, you know, like incredibly lonely. But the research on the, not just the psychological effect, but the physiological effect of the feeling, the experience of loneliness, down to, you know, like dramatic increase for risk of disease, for inflammation. It's stunning how it affects you. And like you said, you know, the most effective and free treatment is to be reconnected with other human beings, or reconnected with, you know, like other beings, whether they're people or animals or nature or all. And yet still we hang on to this notion that like the purest unit, the ultimate aspiration, is for me to be utterly self-reliant as a human being. And especially now, it's causing so much harm.
Yeah. Well, that's partly why I wrote the book, because individualism is on the rise. The strong man, patriarchy, traditional masculinity is all, there's been a great backlash. And there's this upsurge of all of this nonsense. Relationality is the only thing that will make us happy. It is the panacea. It's the pearl of great price. I deal with a lot of high-powered guys. And I speak to them about what I call the difference between gratification and relational joy. Mm. Gratification is a short-term hit of pleasure. It's great. Pretty girl smiles at you. You make a hit on the stock market. All good. I like gratification in this place. Relational joy, and think of parenting. Relational joy is a deeper down pleasure. Sometimes it's gratifying, sometimes it's a pain in the ass, but it's the pleasure of just being there and being in connection with the person. I tell a story about my son, Alexander. When he was little, he was a maniac. And I was giving him a timeout. He had to be like 3 foot. We didn't have locks, so I was holding his bedroom door shut and he was trying to get it open. You know, lightning was coming out of his, thunderclouds. And there was a part of me that wanted to throw a little bugger right out the window. I mean, I hated him. But a deeper down part of me was like, you mighty little spirit, you're going to do just great. And I talked to people in general and men in particular. Many of the men that I see have lived most of their lives out of their adaptive child, have been governed by gratification, and have little to no relational joy. And I tell this story, if I may. Now, I'm proud to say none other than Bruce Springsteen wrote the foreword to my book, and he quite generously spoke about, referenced his work with me and Patty, very, very generous of him. So this is not Bruce. I've worked a lot with Hollywood people and musicians and celebs. This is a rock and roll star. And he told me when he was on stage, he was alive. When he was at home with his family, he was like a computer on sleep mode. He was really depressed. And I talked to him over time, as I do many of the men I work with, about what I call becoming a true family man, getting up out of yourself and giving. So his 4 kids would be like, Daddy, Daddy, no. And he began to say, okay, yes. And I began to teach him about relational joy and about the pleasure of deep connection. And he came to me one day and he said, I just spent the best day of my life. I said, okay. It wasn't in a stadium in front of 60,000 people. He said, my wife and kids and I spent all day Sunday in our PJs. We played a 10-hour vicious game of sadomonopoly. And I forgot all about everything. I was in the moment with my family. It was the happiest day of my life. That's relational joy. And that's what will fulfill us. And nothing else can take its place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. It sounds like, and it's been around for time immemorial. As you were describing it, two things came into my mind. One is, in Buddhism, one of the four immeasurables is loosely translated to appreciative joy, which is a lot of what you're describing. But the way that I learned the concept that you're talking about, actually, it comes from a Yiddish term, naches. And this is, for those who don't know the word or the feeling, this is the joy that you feel when somebody who you love so unconditionally goes out into the world, succeeds, whatever it may be, that you feel their elation, their joy as your own. And you wish it for them, and it's not about you. It's just you seeing them, people who you love, go out and have this incredible feeling, gives you that same feeling. In an interesting way, it's both selfless and self-centered.
Well, I talk about the difference between short-term greed and enlightened self-interest.
Yeah.
Being related is self-interest. It's just wise self-interest.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's an important distinction. You've used the word intimacy a number of times also. And one of the things you write about is a modified version of that term, what you call fierce intimacy. What's the distinction here?
Fierce intimacy is my shorthand for the capacity to take each other on. Most couples stop taking each other on after a few years, and they tell themselves that they're compromising or accepting, but they're really settling. And resentment builds, sexuality dies. The first casualty when you stop being honest with each other is sex and your eroticism. And what I say is that there's a reason why people back off of each other, because they don't have the skills to pull it off and have it be successful. You tell your partner the truth about what ails you, and they get defensive, or they block it, or they counter with what ails, or. They don't know the skills of repair. Historically, we have never wanted more from our relationships than we do right now. Our grandparents' generation didn't care about all this stuff. If nobody beat each other or drank too much, they were fine. Nowadays, We really want to be lifelong lovers. We want long walks on the beach, holding hands. We want great sex in their 70s and 80s. We want heart-to-heart talks. We really want a lifelong lover relationship, but our anti-relational, narcissistic, addictive, patriarchal, individualistic culture does not give our sons and daughters what they need to pull off this ambition. So that's where the book comes in. First, you need a map, how to start thinking relationally instead of individualistically. And then you need a set of tools, how to, for example, stand up for yourself and cherish your partner at the same time, how to digest grief, what to do when you're in your wise adult and your partner's stuck in his or her adaptive child and they ain't coming out, how to tolerate disappointment. These are all essential skills in a relationship, which I would love taught in elementary school and junior high and high, but which we need to be taught as adults because we didn't learn them in the family growing up and we didn't learn them in this culture. We can do better.
Yeah. And underneath all of that, and this is one of the things that you write as well, you write, we must face with compassion our own orphaned parts, our shame and judgments. So part of it is about skills, but part of it also is sort of saying, okay, let me look at this adapted child. Let me look at these things that are within me. And, you know, so part of it is about skilling your way into this fierce intimacy and this like developing something that we all yearn for. But it sounds like part of it also is not focusing on self-awareness for the purpose of deepening into individualism, but focusing on self-awareness and self-discovery for the purpose of being able to bring yourself more wholly, more openly, more fully to a relationship.
That's exactly right. We have to tend, you know, these inner children. And in the book and in my work, I talk a lot about your inner adaptive child and wounded child. I do personification work where I have big burly guys talk to their little boy in a chair and put their arms around them. But what you need, these inner children are really just personifications of trauma states. They're the you at the age you were when you were traumatized and what you were experiencing then and how you adapted to that experience. It got frozen in time. And over again, I bring the wise adult part of you into relationship with these younger parts of you. One of the things I say is that maturity comes when we tend to our inner children and don't foist them off on our partners to deal with.
Mm. Yeah. And as you write, intimacy is, this is not something that we just magically have. This is something that we do. You know, it's something that it feels like it's less just a matter of who we are. It's a matter of the way that we move into our lives and the way that we make decisions and take actions. And it arises from that.
Including actions that heal our own trauma from the past.
Yeah.
Our relationships are a great crucible for that. You know, my darling wife, Belinda, will look at me when I'm being particularly obnoxious and get that little smile of hers and kind of bow and say, I just want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to work on myself.
Beautiful. Well, this feels like a good place for us to come full circle in our conversation as well. So in this container of Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To live a good life? To live a life of authentic connection to myself, to the people I love, to my society, to people who are unlike me, other cultures, other races, to nature and the planet at large, and ultimately to connection to spirit, The largest wise adult in the arena. Hmm. I had a guy I worked with, and he had a beautiful image. He was triggered, very triggered. And his image, he closed his eyes and he visualized he was putting his arms around his overwhelmed little boy and spirit was putting its arms around both of them. Maybe we'll end with that.
Mm, beautiful. Thank you.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, before you leave, if you love this episode, safe bet you'll also love the conversation that we had with Julie and John Gottman about how to build deeper loving relationships. You'll find a link to Julie and John's episode in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, go ahead and follow Good Life Project in your favorite listening app. And if you appreciate the work that we've been doing here on Good Life Project, go check out my new book, Spark. It'll reveal some incredibly eye-opening things about maybe one of your favorite subjects, you, and then show you how to tap these insights to reimagine and reinvent work as a source of meaning, purpose, and joy. You'll find a link in the show notes, or you can also find it at your favorite bookseller now. Until next time, I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.